You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to NPR's technology correspondent about her new memoir about her life as an immigrant in New York and her family's experience with the justice system. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, checking in with reporters around the state. First, the state's Joint Finance Committee met yesterday debating a plan to boost public defender pay. It also signed off on a legal settlement involving the state, the first time it's done so since getting the power to do that from laws signed late last year. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Laurel, hi.
Hi, Rob.
Let's start with this conversation about public defender pay. Until recently, Wisconsin paid its public defenders less than any other state. What's the Joint Finance Committee looking at here?
So the Joint Finance Committee is looking at doing another bump to public defender pay in Wisconsin. They already did a little bit in the state budget, but not as much as they did for assistant district attorneys, prosecutors in Wisconsin. So a number of public defenders came to the Capitol to testify and say, hey, we really feel like we need parity as public defenders with prosecutors in Wisconsin. Under this proposal that's up for consideration, it'd be a lot closer to that.
Was there pushback to that idea?
Not that we heard of during the committee on, earlier this week. I think, this is something that the state has been grappling with for quite a while. We've had really low pay for public defenders. We've had a pretty low rate for hiring private lawyers to be public defenders as well. That was something that lawmakers also made a change to in the state budget. They increased it from $40 an hour to $70 an hour. That previous rate was the lowest in the country. So I think because of the extent of this conversation and the amount of time lawmakers have been talking about it, there's been some consensus built.
Staying with legal issues and joint finance, Laurel, the Budget Committee approved the first legal settlement for the state since it got that power from laws signed before Governor Evers and Attorney General Call were sworn in. Can you remind us about the confusion that those laws seem to have caused in terms of settling lawsuits?
So kind of the push and pull here is between the Democratic Attorney General, Josh Call, and the Joint Finance Committee. Call has said that he can't share information about a number of pending legal settlements because it would violate confidentiality requirements that are put in place in a number of legal agreements. And he's asked lawmakers, hey, would you sign non-disclosure agreements so I can share this information with you legally? Lawmakers don't want to do that because it's a public meeting. They say they have transparency requirements as state legislators. So there's been kind of an impasse here in terms of how lawmakers are going to get the information about these potential settlements. Well, this week we saw a little bit of a change because they were able to take up this one case. But it's kind of a unique case because both parties agreed to lift any confidentiality so lawmakers could discuss this openly and publicly about, coming to an agreement about a settlement.
But other settlements might not be able to waive that confidentiality, and they're still up in the air, it sounds like.
Absolutely. So it would be up to the discretion of the individuals involved in the lawsuit, whether they were comfortable with making a similar decision. Of course, we don't know who would choose to do that or not. We know that there are more than a dozen cases that are kind of queued up within the State Department of Justice that are pending settlements with the state, some of which could get the state millions of dollars. So this is something that lawmakers and the attorney general are going to have to figure out if they're going to take those up.
Laurel, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. She gave us some updates from yesterday's meeting in the state's Joint Finance Committee. Now, Green Bay's mayor has put forth his proposed budget for the city. It includes a new position, resilience coordinator. Rob Menser is a WPR News reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Mayor Eric Genrich of Green Bay has proposed creating this city resilience coordinator. What would this person do?
So this would be focused on sort of dealing with the effects of climate change as the city of Green Bay experiences them. That is sort of most visibly seen in Green Bay has had serious problems with flooding just this year. They've had the wettest year on record in 2019, and it resulted in some pretty serious floods in the spring. But even in there was flooding in the fall and other times they've dealt with that. So So Genrich wants this resilience coordinator to look at options for green infrastructure, which could help to catch some of the rainwater and prevent flooding, but also to coordinate with neighboring communities, with the county government on looking at sort of like this as a watershed issue, and then also to look at broader sort of renewable energy goals for the city and other types of changes that Green Bay could make.
And how are they talking about paying for this?
So this is proposed as only 25% of it would come from sort of city funding, and that's funded out of the stormwater utility. And there's another 75% that would be funded with private grants. And of course, that's always – you don't know for sure if the city would receive the grants. But Genrich said that they're pretty confident that they'd be able to reach that funding mark.
Is there a timeline for a final decision on this?
The city's finance committee discussed it this week and didn't make changes to the proposal. And it'll go before Green Bay City Council on Tuesday.
Switching gears, Rob, I want to follow up on something we talked about a few weeks back, the fundraising effort to save the historic Fox Theater in Stevens Point from demolition. Looks like bad news for organizers of that effort.
Yeah, bad news indeed. The renovation efforts, the nonprofit group that was working on that was not able to come to an agreement with the city on an appropriate timeline for renovations, and they have, as a result, abandoned their efforts to renovate the space. And the city engineers say that it needs to come down before the snow falls in quantities. So it is likely to face the wrecking ball in coming weeks.
The building is going. Is there still going to be an effort to make the kind of hub that they were, a cultural hub that they were hoping to use that building for?
Absolutely, and that is something that the mayor of Stevens Point is a strong advocate for, and it will be in fact in the same space as the plans go. It'll still be in that downtown spot, but the historic building, the 1894 theater that has been there and has been vacant for a long time, that building will not be the home to it.
Rob, thanks a lot for the updates.
All right, thank you.
Rob Metzer is WPR's reporter based in Wausau. He told us about the fate of the Fox Theater in Stevens Point and a proposal in Green Bay to hire a city resilience coordinator. Now we head to southeastern Wisconsin, where the Racine County Board recently voted down a resolution that would have made all board members ineligible for health insurance benefits. Currently, 10 of the 21 supervisors can get coverage from the county. Ricardo Torres is a reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. Ricardo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the vote that happened this week, give us some background. How did the Racine County Board get to this point where about half of its 21 members are eligible for health insurance benefits?
So in 2011, the Racine County Board passed a resolution that basically said any new county board members starting in 2012 would not be allowed to have health insurance. And the old board members, those that were on the board in 2011 and before, would be able to still keep their health insurance. And so over the years, over the last 8 years, as new county board members went on and other county board members left or were defeated at the polls, the number of county board members on the health insurance started ticking down. And so over these last 8 years, that's how it went from 20 board members having health insurance to now 10 having the ability of being eligible to have health insurance.
Part of the concern is this is still, it sounds like, a decent chunk of the county board's budget. Is that right?
Of the budget, yes. But of the county budget overall, it's less than 1% of what the actual county budget is. But of the county board budget, it's still a pretty significant chunk, about a third. And that's just on like what is being paid for these county board supervisors. County employees across the board in Racine are going to see an increase in their health insurance payment, and county board supervisors are also feeling that increase as well if they stay on the board. So there's been quite a bit of health changes here in Racine.
And now we have one board member making a proposal to get rid of health insurance for everybody, even the people who are sort of, I guess, grandfathered in under the old system. What was the case they made for getting rid of this?
The case they made, it was Supervisor Janet Bernberg. She was saying that unlike county employees, county board supervisors aren't full-time, that they aren't putting in the 40 hours or 30 hours a week to do their jobs. And what the response was that some board members say, although we don't clock in for 40 hours a week, we are on call 24/7. You know, we have constituents calling us. We do our homework going into committee meetings, going into board meetings. And so it's not a typical 40-hour a week job, but there was some disagreement as to, you know, what is actually full-time when it comes to a county board supervisor. And the resolution was defeated at the committee of the whole, and so it doesn't seem like it'll be going forward again at this point, but it's possible. I did talk to Supervisor Bernberg after the meeting, and she did say that she plans to propose a similar resolution in the future.
Ricardo, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
Ricardo Torres is a reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. He talked with us about the Racine County Board voting to keep health insurance coverage available to supervisors elected prior to 2012. He wrapped up our weekly roundup of news from around the state. Coming up, an NPR correspondent shares her new memoir about life in the United States in a family of immigrants. We'll meet the author of Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Twitter says it will ban all political ads, but Facebook says not only will it have them, ads from politicians won't get fact-checked. We'll explore the frontiers of politics on social media. Now, our next guest is probably a name you've heard before. Aarti Shahani is a technology correspondent for NPR. She's a regular on Morning Edition and NPR newscasts. But in a new book, she's telling her own story and the story of her family's experience as immigrants in Queens, New York, trying to navigate the United States and the justice system. Aarti Shahani joins us now. Aarti, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, as I said, a lot of our listeners probably know you from your stories on NPR. I understand it took you some time to decide whether you wanted to write a book and tell your own story.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I joke that if you've heard my voice before, I'm your Indian IT lady. I am delivering the news on Google, on Facebook. You know, really important questions, for example, about the impact of technology on democracy. But, you know, I've had for a long time a story inside me that at some point I just felt like I needed to share with our listeners, with the public. And it's specifically the story of how my family made America home. We came here when I was a baby. We overstayed tourist visas and were undocumented for a few years. We then were able to get our green cards through a family petition, a process that's now derided as chain migration. And then we thought we were on the fast track to the American dream. But then when I was 16, my father was arrested and he was charged with helping the Cali drug cartel of Colombia with cleaning their dirty drug money. And this case kind of meandered through the courts and ended up lingering far longer than my family thought it would and pretty much defined my life from age 16 to age 30. And so, you know, it became important to me that my country, that our audience know a little bit of the backstory behind this now, you know, you could say model minority or professional immigrant or whatever good immigrant sort of model light you could cast me in. I was undocumented. My dad was in jail and we fought like hell to stay together in this country.
I think a lot of times people think of immigrants in a shorthand. It might be a good or a bad one, you know, a stirring tale of overcoming adversity or a threat, depending on who is picturing the immigrant. I think your story shows it's messy. We're people and we have stories and they're going to be different for every immigrant family.
Thank you for saying that, because they're going to be different for every family, right?
Right.
I feel like, if anything, part of what I'm doing in my memoir, and Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, is just highlighting the fact that immigrants are people, too, and we are multidimensional, and our families can be very messy. you know, I basically went through the journey of my father, you know, when he was arrested. He was a shopkeeper. Okay. He had a small electronics store in Manhattan on the exact same block where he used to shovel snow for $4 and $5 an hour. You know, he was achieving his dream. And then he got caught up in a pretty much a kind of underwhelming or failed drug war investigation where prosecutors needed to prosecute somebody. And they got the shopkeeper and they said, hey, take an 8-month plea and put the matter behind you. And my father did that upon advice of his counsel. And then it spiraled into a deportation case we didn't even know was coming as a second surprise punishment. And, you know, my father, legally, he became a quote unquote criminal alien, right? He's a non-citizen. He was a green card holder, a non-citizen who's now embroiled in legal problems. And it's kind of always bothered me the way we talk about immigrants who get in trouble, because that's what my family had going on. And you know what? That's a lot of families. And it's like, it's what happens when you're trying to survive economically. Every small business owner, for example, cuts corners in some ways. That's, I know this as a business reporter. I can tell you definitively this is the case. And so I think that what I was trying to do in my memoir, and here we are, is tell a really honest story about what does it actually look like when you come to this country and you're trying to make it. And not just from the standpoint of economically, but even in our own family, like the culture clash, you know, like one of the things I puzzle over in the book is how did my father, who was, he was a stranger when I was growing up. I didn't feel connected to him. I didn't really like him. He was just like the old world guy who complained about my skirt length and, you know, how tight my shirt was. And, you know, he would never have imagined that his baby girl could make money from her big mouth. You know, like that was out of the question. Like in America, these things are possible. But I didn't really feel any connection to him. And this stranger, sometimes adversary, you know, he ended up becoming my best friend, unfortunately, in a very painful process through a legal battle that we fought. But, you know, as I've been traveling the country and having the opportunity to talk about Here We Are with people who've read it or who will read it, one thing that's come up a lot is, you know, there is nothing more important in one's life than your relationship with your family. I mean, it defines you, whether you embrace it, whether you ignore it and push it away, it is at the center of who you are. And part of what I'm investigating here is how did Dad and I end up becoming best friends after the huge distance that we started with, you know?
Talking to NPR's Aarti Shahani about her new book. It is called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. Aarti, you start off the story telling the story of going back to meet the judge in your dad's case and really finding out that with better representation, things could have gone very differently.
Yeah, it was a real punch in the stomach. I ended up interviewing about 100 people for this book. And one of the people, didn't even start as an interview, is, you know, life kind of moved on and things happened. And I entered what I call my fancy world. I was no longer working class immigrant daughter struggling to make it, but I was now an NPR correspondent and getting to meet all kinds of people. And it turns out that I had friends in common, professional friends in common with the judge who hit the gavel in my family's case. That's weird, okay? That doesn't typically happen, okay? That is weird. And anyway, our mutual friend email introduced us, reintroduced us again. The judge invited me to his chambers to come and chat with him. And I hadn't seen him since I was a teenager. I was now in my 30s. I decided to take up the invite. I didn't know why, but I just had this sort of curiosity. Maybe that's why I became a journalist, is this insatiable curiosity. I went and I met him, and the very first words out of his mouth, I mean, before I sat down, while we were shaking hands, his very first words were, your father, as well as your uncle, my uncle was in the case too, he said, your father and your uncle should never have taken that guilty plea. What a mistake. And, you know, here's the difference, though, between being a journalist and a daughter. As journalists, when we hear something like that, our interest is piqued. Oh, tell me more. As a daughter, when he told me that the pain my family went through on a miscalculation, I literally just wanted to collapse. I felt the spirit leave my body. It hurt.
you closed your book with a message to your father, who has since passed on. Can you talk about, after going through this experience and revisiting your life and interviewing so many people who played positive and negative roles in it, what then was your message for your dad?
Oh, you know, it's funny that the end of the book, I realized that part of what I was working through was a kind of personal question, a personal crisis that I think a lot of recent immigrants go through. Was it a mistake to come to America? Because being here was not easy, especially for my father. I fought like hell to keep him in this country. And I wondered if I'd fought like hell really against his will, and that he was going along with the fight and not folding upon my insistence. Writing the book helped me to come to peace with that. And ultimately, you know, when I write a letter to my father at the end of the book, what I'm telling him is I believe after really recounting our lives and interviewing people and revisiting the chronology of what happened, as well as the way in which he passed away, I feel that he was telling me, no, we didn't make a mistake. And even though it was hard, it was worth fighting to stay in America.
And briefly, as we wrap up, you are concerned that some of the doors that stayed open for you and your family back in the 80s might be closed for somebody in the same situation today. And just our last half a minute or so, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, as a statement of fact, my family came in through a petition that was processed in a handful of years. Today, that same petition would be more than 20 years for the few people eligible. We no longer have lines for people to stand on. You want people to stand in line, you have to create lines for them. I'm very concerned that our nation of immigrants does not have lines to stand on.
Arthi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Arthi Shahani, technology correspondent for NPR. She joins today to talk about her new memoir. It's called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. Coming up, we'll talk about how some of the big social media platforms are handling political advertising, or choosing not to handle it at all, as the 2020 election campaign wraps up. Ramps up, I should say. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent continues a series on healthcare advice for every age. This time around, Kate and her guests look at the biggest health issues facing people in their 30s. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, some of the largest social media platforms are gearing up for the 2020 elections, and there's a growing divide over how to handle political advertising. Facebook has been taking criticism for its policy not to fact-check ads from political campaigns. And in the complete opposite direction, Twitter says it's going to ban all political ads on its platform worldwide. Both moves could have a big impact on the 2020 presidential campaign. Margo Suska is a professor of journalism and mass communication at American University in Washington, D.C. Margo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
Before we get to the particulars, Margo, how big a role do our social media play now in our political campaigns?
I think that what 2016 showed us is that social media played a pivotal role in presidential elections. And in 2020, I think we've got to look ahead to see that it is going to play an even larger role, with tens of millions of dollars in ad revenue pouring in. Messages, you know, everything ranging from advertisements as well as news content about candidates being shared there. Social media overwhelmingly is becoming the spot for discourse in political campaigns.
Let's go to Facebook now. Can you tell us more about what they've decided to do when it comes to political ads?
I think it's more what Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg discussed this in the last couple of weeks about what they're not going to do that made news. Essentially, Mark Zuckerberg is saying that you know, all of a sudden he is the expert in free speech, and he will not, what he considers, censor political advertisements. He also will not allow Facebook to take down political advertisements that they know have outright lies in them. So what he's saying is, in the marketplace of ideas, let it run. And there have been, he faced criticism, as you know, on Capitol Hill for not doing more and not taking more action. Elizabeth Warren, Democratic candidate for president, she got involved in the debate by purposely running an ad saying that, kind of a snarky ad saying that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg was supporting Donald Trump for his re-election campaign, and she was saying, look how ludicrous this is, that I can run this ad that is completely false, and you won't take it down. So a lot of implications, I think, looking ahead to 2020 in big news from both Twitter and Facebook these last couple of weeks.
Well, speaking of Facebook, CEO Mark Zuckerberg on Capitol Hill, here's part of an exchange he had with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Would I be able to run advertisements on Facebook targeting Republicans in primary saying that they voted for the Green New Deal? I mean, if you're not fact-checking political advertisements, I'm just trying to understand the bounds here. What's fair game?
Congresswoman, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think
so probably, you don't know if I'll be able to do that?
I think probably.
What do you make of that hypothetical?
Well, I think that what she showed with her questioning was, and he eventually had to cave to her and say, "Well, yes, you would be able to run that ad." Now, what's interesting is that in the days since that exchange, Facebook did remove an ad saying that there was a Republican senator who supported the Green New Deal, which would be contrary to their political beliefs. But it was removed because it had been put up, Zuckerberg said, or Facebook said, because it was run not by a politician, but by a political action campaign.
Here's a little more of that exchange between Zuckerberg and Ocasio-Cortez with his rationale on the policy.
Do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact-checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad, and I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad. That's different from it being, in our position, the right thing to do to prevent your constituents or people in an election from seeing that you had lied.
So the idea there, and this is a little different for candidates and office holders themselves. They're the ones who, in particular, don't appear to get any fact-checking under this policy. Is there a case to be made there? Okay, if you're a politician, you should be able to say what you want, and then your constituents can judge you if they think you've lied.
Well, I would certainly think, I mean, as a person who's responsible for the ethics class here in the School of Communication at American University, I would say, yes, of course, we want our politicians and our media to act ethically. So, yes, of course, I think that Zuckerberg makes a good point. But I think he also then, what he's doing is creating a distraction away from the power that Facebook has, from the way that politicians use the platform, from everything that we know concerns about both fake news and disinformation that's been put out into society through the platform that he created, from the platform he profits from. Facebook does not need to do much in order to help Americans make voting decisions, and they are completely skirting what I would say is their professional responsibility here. It's getting harder for Americans to do the work of being citizens when you have this amount of disinformation and misinformation in society. Zuckerberg knows that. They could allow it, and if they wanted to, they could have, even have some kind of a meter showing that how false it is, something in the line of what PolitiFact does. And that would take a fraction of the revenue that they earn from political advertisements. I don't believe that Zuckerberg, when he's saying politicians shouldn't lie, yes, we all hope that in our American democratic process. But the idea that he is not taking more responsibility for the platform that he helped create and that is so powerful both politically and economically is quite frankly ridiculous in my opinion.
Talking to Margo Suska, professor of journalism and mass communication at American University, looking at Facebook, Twitter, and how they're handling political advertising. Margo, for non-social media, what kind of policies are out there for newspapers, TV, radio to decide, hey, this candidate is wanting to run an ad, we think it's factually wrong, we're going to not play it?
Well, that, I mean, that's actually a good point. Listen, during political campaigns, news media, whether that's newspapers or your local broadcast affiliate or cable television, they make a lot of money off of political advertisements. That being said, generally what you have in the newspaper realm are more ethical decisions about what's going to go into content. But you still have the Federal Elections Commission, the Federal Trade Commission taking a look at what is considered advertisements, but in terms of what is a lie, those are really decisions that individual media organizations are going to have to stand to in order for ads that come out on those different platforms, whether those be print, broadcast, cable, or now, as we're seeing, digital. And what makes digital advertising so different, I want to make sure your listeners who aren't on social media understand this, is the way that these algorithms are created for this micro-targeted type of advertising. And that's really what people are starting to question is, in the digital realm, the advertising that is so targeted, and if it is a lie, I mean, these are huge concerns about the kind of information that's being targeted to specific users.
Then there's Twitter. Jack Dorsey, the Twitter CEO, sent a series of tweets this week saying, we're going to be done taking political ads. What do you make of that approach?
Well, I think it's interesting, and I think it's Twitter is about 22% of Americans use Twitter. It does not have the reach that Facebook has. So Facebook has a reach in America, if you look at users between 25 and 49 years old, roughly 8 in 10 Americans are using Facebook at that age group. Twitter, for all Americans, about 22%. They tend to be younger, more educated, and they vote in the Democratic, with a large D, for Democratic Party. So the fact that Twitter is saying, well, we're not going to take or allow any political advertisements, I think is not really as dominant as Facebook saying it's going to allow the kind of content that it's going to allow. I think the other thing that's so interesting about this debate, and that some we may be forgetting in the conversation, is that neither Zuckerberg nor Dorsey are talking about other kinds of content that they allow on their social media platforms that may be dressed up as news, that may be misinformation, that may be coming from different bots or other content that may be coming in from other countries. So I'm thrilled we're having a debate about political advertisements, but I think we need to have a larger conversation about the content that's coming through that may be influencing the political process in other ways before 2020.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Saeed is with us in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I think the minute we empower Facebook to decide what can and can't go on, when we make them the arbiter of truth, we have endowed them with power beyond what should be given to a non-publicly elected and publicly accountable organization. Bias is inherent in every human endeavor. And so if they can choose what is the truth, then their bias will color the outcomes of our elections. So I think Zuckerberg's position is, in fact, the correct one.
Saeed, thanks for the call. What do you think, Margo?
Well, I think that what's left out of this debate about political advertising is the way that Facebook, when something is flagged as potentially damaging content, the way that Facebook uses third-party cleaners to look at that content, oftentimes in other countries, including the Philippines. So I think that this idea that Facebook allows every idea out into the marketplace and is therefore, you know, creating this huge venue for free speech is just simply not true. I mean, there is a lot of content that gets censored that really would be considered political or artistic speech that in other media would get through. So I appreciate what the caller is saying. I just think that, you know, Facebook saying it's this bastion of free speech is just not something that that it does.
Thanks for that call, Saeed. We're talking to Margo Suska, professor of journalism and mass communication at American University. She's with us to talk about social media and political advertising. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these policies of Facebook saying they will not fact check ads from politicians in their campaigns? Twitter saying we're not going to run paid political advertising at all anymore? Do you think social media companies should be making sure political ads that show up on their sites are accurate? Do you think political ads don't belong on social media at all? as a person on social media? Are you just sick of political stuff on social media, period? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about how social media companies are approaching political ads. Twitter says it's going to ban all paid political ads. Facebook says it will allow them, and it won't fact-check ads from politicians. Margo Suska is with us from American University, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think if Facebook takes money to run ads from campaigns, it should do some level of fact-checking, or should it be anything goes when campaigns are involved? Would you be happy to see political ads disappear from your social media of choice? Do you think social media companies should say when something is inaccurate or misleading? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Linda is with us in Green Bay. Linda, hi.
Hi. I truly believe that making Facebook the truth police can devolve really quickly into asking them to check our teenagers' postings for truthfulness, and that could be a nightmare for everybody. What I think should happen is that Facebook should have some type of agreement, and the onus of truth-telling should be on the advertiser, not on Facebook. So Facebook should have some type of agreement that if the advertisement is not true, is found not to be true, that the advertiser would have to pay a $100,000 fine or some type of fine, and then remove the advertisement.
But Linda, who then makes the call on the truthfulness in this idea you have?
Well, it would have to be reported to Facebook, you know, and then, you know, just like you report all that ugly stuff that that you don't want to see, report it to them, and then they can investigate whether or not it's true. But the agreement would be a deterrent to make sure that people would put stuff out there that was truthful.
Interesting. Linda, thanks for the call. Margo, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think the question, and she brings up this point again, which is having content flagged. And the issue is that those are not Facebook employees who are double checking when something is flagged that is considered a violation of the platform standards. Oftentimes those are third party people who are working on those, often from Southeast Asia. So the idea that Facebook, which says it employs a large network of people looking at content and things that are flagged, that's not happening from its California offices or from other space, even in the United States. So my concern would be if it's going to continue that, if something were flagged in the case of what your caller said, who's going to be the one checking that? So that would be my concern.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Susan in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi. I've really been curious for some time about why, going back in history, we thought that the public airwaves were owned by the people, and there used to be advertising time that was allowed for public service announcements, for instance, that's gone. So why don't we, I think, in a political ad, political information related to our elections, have a system of laws for a variety of types of communication that we create guidelines for? I think about my elderly father looking at the mail that he received that was so full of disinformation. And so I guess I'd like to just kind of expand the question, if I could, and see what your, guest thinks about that.
Susan, thanks for the call. The airwaves is a public resource, and maybe the internet as well.
Well, I think it's actually in my censorship class. We were just talking about this today, so I'm so glad your caller called in, where we were talking about whether or not those restrictions on when we had the fairness doctrine in place, that is, if you had one person viewpoint on one issue, you had to bring in the other side or offer equal space or equal time to that under FCC rules of the publicly owned broadcast system. So whether or not that would amounted to censorship. And, you know, so there are some clearly defined rules, or maybe less defined since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, but about the operating on the public spectrum. The internet is a whole other animal, right? I mean, it's this whole other privately owned, for-profit business. And, you know, I want to just make sure your callers understand, Facebook in 2016 Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump combined spent $81 million on Facebook ads. We're not talking about just, you know, small change in a, you know, an ad in the, you know, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I mean, this is $81 million, and already candidates this year have spent above $35 million with more than a year to go. I mean, this is not a small amount of money. This is huge revenue that Facebook is bringing in for this.
We're talking to Margo Suska from American University about political advertising and social media. Margo, I want to get into something you touched on earlier, that it isn't just the paid advertising. People are pointing out that, hey, Russian-backed influence campaigns reached, I think it was something like 150 million Americans on Facebook with misleading messages, either intended to be divisive in some cases or to support candidate Trump in other cases. You wanted that to be part of this conversation, too. What would you hope to see there?
Well, listen, I mean, I think that's part of why Facebook is finally, why Zuckerberg is in front of people in Congress, and why he gave this impassioned speech at Georgetown a couple of weeks ago, is that we're starting to see some cracks in the Facebook facade here. Let's remember the Cambridge Analytica scandal. The Federal Trade Commission with the Justice Department unveiled a $5 billion fine against Facebook for violating its own users' privacy. I mean, so we've got big concerns about how is Facebook using our information. So when I say it goes beyond political ads, I think that Facebook has been forced to answer some big questions about what it's doing with what we thought for years was just harmless entertainment and fun and reconnecting with friends and family around the globe. So I think that what I ask us to consider is just how it plays this role in our social systems, in our entertainment systems, but in our news ecosystem, it has to answer for the way it's playing a role. And Facebook, when you include Instagram and WhatsApp, has 2.7 billion users globally. I mean, this is just beyond anybody's, you know, wildest dreams in terms of how powerful it's become and how large its reach is. So I just, you know, Zuckerberg has got to be able to answer to some of these questions. And of course, Elizabeth Warren has flat out said she wants them to answer for antitrust concerns and whether or not they're operating as a monopoly. It'd be interesting to see what that looks like politically going ahead into 2020.
We've been talking about corporate policy for Facebook and Twitter, a little bit about government policy. Do you have suggestions for policy for individuals, the people who are social media users, to protect themselves from disinformation and to not spread disinformation?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point, right? In 2018, MIT came out with a study that showed fake news spread faster in the 2016 election than real news did. So I think now whether or not it was done intentionally or whether or not someone shared it to their Facebook page if they thought it was funny or humorous, I mean, that they didn't look at. But I think that users have got to question what they see on social media in ways that understanding some of these threats to privacy, understanding now that we know Facebook isn't going to police that content, I would say look at it with a very critical eye. And I think users have got to go into the next year looking at the types of news stories that get posted, the types of content that are shared on their wall or that are going viral. And that goes for Twitter as well, just trying to be extremely critical of the content and using a more critical approach. Is this what it claims to be? Especially if they don't know or recognize the source of that information.
In our last few moments, what are you watching for? What's the next part of the story you're paying attention to?
Well, I think, listen, free speech is messy, and I think that is a conversation. I'm thrilled that Zuckerberg is bringing up the issues of free speech, and with issues of hate speech and issues of online forums where we're seeing a megaphone being given to people on the alt-right, I think we've got to be prepared to tackle how we're going to address these concerns in a democratic society.
Margo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Margo Suska, professor of journalism and mass communication at American University in Washington, D.C. She was with us today to talk about how Facebook and Twitter are approaching political advertising ahead of next year's presidential election campaign. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a lot of colleges and their students are pursuing degrees that point to particular careers. Find out why many economics experts are saying we need more English majors. Get the inside scoop on Wisconsin Public Radio on this month's edition of Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane shares the latest WPR news. You can join in with your questions and your comments. And communities around the state are adding wheel taxes on cars as a way to pay for local road maintenance. We'll find out how they work and why local governments are starting to feel like it may be the only option for them. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.